Chapter 13. Two Biscuits. Missy Hudson is not happy.
There's no way I can do what you're suggesting, she says firmly. I can't just abandon my patients.
John has spent the morning attempting to persuade Missy to leave London for her own safety. It seems obvious to him. She has been attacked twice, there's been a murder two doors away, and it's possible that the perpetrators may have also killed 300 passengers by somehow sabotaging their plane. But of course, Missy doesn't see it that way. Her own personal safety is the last thing on her mind.
The ward is completely full, John, she continues. We're rushed off our feet from morning till night. It's not just the patients, I owe it to the other nurses.
You won't be much use to them with a bullet in your head,
Holmes says, wandering into the kitchen. He has borrowed a pair of Finn's pyjamas from the boxes in the extra room upstairs. They're far too small for him, the legs ending halfway up his calves, the sleeves just past his elbow, and the buttons straining across his chest. He looks like an overgrown child.
It won't be for long, John insists.
He casts a withering glance in Holmes's direction. Holmes ignores him.
Lestrade is already on the track of these people. He believes he can trace their bank details through the lawyer's documents.
He can't, Holmes says, helping himself to a croissant. If they really have the technical know-how to take a plane out of the sky, hiding their identity will hardly present much of a challenge. Besides, if a company with the financial resources of Akbar's were unable to stop them, then I doubt the London police will have much chance.
Don't listen to him, John says. Lestrade seems like a really good police officer.
And this Red Circle are really good criminals. If she stays in London, she'll be killed.
So where am I supposed to go?
Missy asks, weakly. John sighs. In one brutal stroke, Holmes has achieved more than he managed in an entire hour of gentle persuasion. Holmes has already worked out the answer.
Why don't you go back to West Norwood? You could stay with Susan Tarleton. The pair of you seem to be getting on unusually well by the time we left the other day.
Holmes breaks the croissant in half, spraying the table with crumbs.
At least, considering you were his wife and she was his mistress.
That's hardly appropriate, Holmes,
John says, rolling his eyes at Missy. But Missy's face is thoughtful.
When we left, she said she was sorry that she couldn't do anything to make up for the hurt she'd caused me.
Well, now she can, Holmes smiles. She kills Finn, she saves you. Everything's all balanced out.
Holmes?
I don't know. Missy isn't convinced.
I suggest you speak to her.
Well, I suppose there's no harm giving it a go.
Missy gets to her feet.
I'll give her a call.
5 minutes later, she returns to the kitchen, looking somewhat bewildered.
She said no?
John asks.
She said she'd be happy to see me. She actually welcomed the idea.
Missy lets out a breath.
Well, that's all sorted then. I'll just go and pack a few things.
We'll walk with you to the station, John says, relieved and annoyed in equal measure.
Are there any more croissants? Holmes asks.
They return to Victoria, but this time they do not go into the station. Missy insists that she doesn't want to hold up their investigation.
Let me know when it's safe to come back, she says.
A thought occurs to her.
Honestly, I take the two of you in and the next thing I know, I'm turned out of my own home.
It's for your own good, John assures her.
Ever since they left Baker Street, John has been thinking about this moment.
How is he going to say goodbye to Missy?
A handshake seems too formal. Sweeping her into his arms and telling her that he will be counting the seconds until he sees her again feels too extravagant by half. A kiss on the cheek could be a decent compromise, but he'll almost certainly make a hash of it.
He'll be too clumsy, and she'll probably push him away, affronted.
It's only now that he realizes how strong his feelings are towards Missy Hudson. At the hospital, she was his friend and ally. Now she is his landlady, and without her, he wouldn't have a roof over his head. Her kindness to Sherlock Holmes affects him too. Dr. John Watson is in love. But Captain John Watson of the Royal Regiment of Fusiliers, invalided out of the army with a bad leg, multiple scars and a problem with alcohol, recognizes that she is far too good for him. As the two men fight it out between them, Missy turns and walks into the station, and by the time they're finished, it's too late. She's gone.
Never mind, Holmes says, as if he has somehow worked out exactly what's happened. She'll be back soon.
So what now? Watson mutters.
The Dorchester Hotel. I think we can walk.
Holmes is right about that, too. The hotel is on Park Lane, not so very far away. They head east from the station, past the walls and razor wire that still surround Buckingham Palace, even though it has long been abandoned by what's left of the royal family, who have returned to the relative safety of Osborne House on the Isle of Wight. They are perhaps unaware of the irony that this was a favourite home of Queen Victoria herself. They cross the corner of Hyde Park and enter Park Lane, once a favoured stamping ground of Saudi princes and Chinese billionaires. But the luxury car showrooms are closed down and empty. Most of the five-star hotels have been boarded up. Even the public art in the street has been torn down and sold for scrap. To say that the Dorchester is a shadow of its former self is an insult to shadows. The entrance doors are missing, many of the ground floor windows are shattered, and faded awnings hang over terraces which look too worn out to support anyone's weight. Even so, the hotel, where a suite once cost as much as £2,000 a night, has retained something of its solidity, still proudly facing the park. It is no longer a hotel. Once the last wealthy guest had moved out, desperate Londoners moved in. It is now used for social housing, although in truth it houses some of the least social people in the country. Holmes and Watson go in, giving a few coins to the homeless family sitting outside the door, and walk over to what was once the reception desk. Bolted to the wall behind is a metal unit with cubbyholes full of letters and junk mail. They start working their way through them, but it doesn't take them too long to find a brochure addressed to Victor Lynch, although it's unlikely that he would be interested in half-price pet insurance.
Room 308, Holmes says, reading the envelope.
Still battered by the beating he received down the alley, John finds it hard going, climbing up to the third floor. All the lifts are out of order, but despite his own recent surgery, Holmes doesn't pause for breath. They follow a landing with a swirly carpet that has lost most of its colour and reach a door at the very end. Holmes knocks, but there is no answer. John's heart sinks. Do we come back another time? Holmes shakes his head.
He's in the room. Listen.
John moves closer to the door and hears the quiet tones of music playing on the radio. And before he can stop him, Holmes is twisting the door handle. The keycard system must have gone down a long time ago, and the door isn't locked. It swings open. Victor Lynch has turned what was once a hotel room into something resembling a home. At first glance, it appears comfortable, even impressive. Double-height windows look out onto the park, with thick curtains hanging on either side. Everything is scrupulously tidy, and in a makeshift kitchen on the left side of the room, neat stacks of food and fuel are arranged beside a brazier, the coals still smouldering in its base. But the room is very small for an entire life. The atmosphere is musty. The hotel furniture, sofa, bed, chandelier, is old and dated.
Who are you? What do you want?
Victor Lynch is around 50 years old, strong and wiry, with a tanned, heavily lined face and shots of grey in his sun-bleached hair. A week's worth of stubble bristles across a jaw crisscrossed with the dinks and scratches of battle, and there is the scar that John remembers on his cheek. He can hear the rattled breathing, too, the result of too many cheap cigarettes supplied by the army to its teen recruits. Lynch is wearing a moth-eaten cardigan and army trousers. He is sitting up against the velvet headboard of a large, canopied bed. He is aiming a service revolver at them. For a moment, nobody moves. Then the gun falls out of Lynch's hand. Despite his muscular arms, it appears he's too weak to support the weight of the weapon. He is having trouble with his vision, too. His eyes are distant, unfocused. John only has vague memories of the soldier he met once in Afghanistan, but the man on the bed seems to have seriously deteriorated. PTSD? Brain damage? It's impossible to tell.
We want to talk to you about Silas Welburn, Holmes says.
Hearing the name, Lynch once again scrabbles for the gun.
Who are you? Who sent you? Have you come for me too?
His fingers brush the weapon, knocking it onto the floor. John is relieved that it is now out of his reach. We know each other, he says.
I don't know you.
My name is Dr. John Watson. I was with the Royal Fusiliers. I treated you at Talakan. Do you remember?
I don't remember anything.
You lived with Silas Welburn in Baker Street.
Holmes has no time for reminiscences. You were the one who found his body. He had been shot.
Get out of here. Leave me alone.
John steps forward. Are you in pain? I was an army surgeon. I might be able to help.
You can't help me, the man rasps. I'm dying.
Taps his skull with a grimy finger.
Brain tumour.
You seen a doctor?
I don't need to see a doctor. I can't see anything. Can't breathe anymore. I can't do anything.
If you would just allow me to examine you, I might be able to... John is interrupted by a loud smash. He spins round. Holmes is standing by the now broken window, holding a large can of tomatoes, his hair stirring in the cold breeze that he has allowed to stream into the room. The stunned silence is broken by a bellow from Lynch.
What did you do that for, you bastard?
He attempts to get up from the bed but falls backwards, his legs kicking like an upturned beetle. John stares.
Holmes? I don't understand.
On the bed, the soldier is close to tears. He only has this habitation, and now it has been vandalized. What is he to do when the cold of winter arrives? But Holmes is unrepentant.
Mr. Lynch hasn't got a brain tumor, Holmes explains, returning the can to its shelf. It was obvious to me the moment I walked in. He's suffering from long-term carbon monoxide poisoning, the headaches and the muscular deterioration. He's been using a brazier in a completely unventilated room.
He addresses Lynch directly.
You're lucky you're not dead.
John stares. He's annoyed with himself. Why didn't he make the connection himself? Come on, he says, helping Lynch off the bed. Let's get you some air.
Somehow he gets the man to the window and lowers him into a nearby armchair.
Lynch immediately falls into a slumber, but as time passes, his breathing eases, and some colour starts to return to his cheeks. Regular checks of his vital signs show that his pulse is getting stronger. London's air may not be clean, but at least it's oxygenated. After an hour or so, Lynch stirs, and the ghost of a smile crosses his face. Returning to his senses, he looks at the broken window as if he has already forgotten what happened.
Looks like I might need to dig out my army thermals, he announces.
I'm afraid my friend didn't think what he was doing, Watson says. He glances accusingly at Holmes. Did you really have to smash the window?
When was the last time you came across a hotel window that actually opened?
Lynch is examining John.
Do I know you?
I told you. We met.
I don't remember. I have no memory.
I'm sure it will return if you keep the room ventilated.
Looks like I have no choice about that, thanks to your friend.
We were asking you about Silas Welburn, Holmes reminds him.
I spoke to the police.
On the contrary, you refused to speak to them.
That's right.
Yes.
John hands him a glass of water, and with a trembling hand, he takes a sip. It's remarkable how rapidly he is recovering.
After I left the army, I was homeless for 6 weeks. The police were my enemy, threatening me, moving me on. Those bastards, honestly. I gave my life for my country. Almost.
He pauses.
I would have died in the street if some charity hadn't set me up in Baker Street. And when that finished, I came here. The Dorchester. Fancy name. Must have been quite a fancy place once.
Silas Welburn? Holmes says.
All right, all right.
Lynch takes more of the water and hands the glass back to John.
Helping hand paid half the rent. They were the charity I mentioned just now. I was there for 9 months, although I couldn't stand the place. Those bloody neighbours.
The Neinimian Mendicants?
Is that what they were called? The bloody chanting, day and night. My room was at the top of the house, where it was loudest. I got Silas to go round and talk to him about it. I shouldn't have bothered. Nothing changed, except that he became more remote, more lost in his own thoughts.
Were you and he friends?
He didn't have friends. Silas Welburn was rich once. He was married. A lawyer with a smart house and Canary Wharf. That all went to pot when he got into the horses. He gambled away his money, his marriage, his entire life. Poor sod. He was always scheming and dreaming. One day he'd get it all back again, that's what he told me. Maybe he did.
What do you mean?
The last time I spoke to him was in Baker Street. I bumped into him quite by chance near Selfridge's and he seemed pleased to see me. He told me he was onto something, and it was thanks to me. I didn't know what he meant by that. I'd left his place by then and moved in here. I couldn't stand the noise anymore.
So Victor Lynch swapped inoffensive chanting for death by carbon monoxide poisoning, John reflects. But he says nothing.
Did he tell you what it was? Holmes asks.
No, but he sounded very pleased with himself. He invited me to visit him back at the house. He said he'd discovered something, and it was going to keep him in pocket for a while to come. He said we should celebrate. That's why I went there, and I wish I hadn't.
Lynch reaches for the water.
The door was open when I got there. And I thought that was strange in itself. Lynch took care of himself. I went up to the kitchen, and that was where I saw it. All that blood. Took me straight back to Talakan.
There is a moment's silence. Then John says,
did he ever mention something called the Red Circle?
Lynch frowns and shakes his head.
I wondered about that. A red circle of his own blood painted on the wall right next to where he lay.
Now you tell me, what sort of a man does that in the last minutes of his life?
He half smiles.
Knowing Silas, I thought it might be a betting tip. That would be just like him. Red circle, 15-1 at Ascot.
It's not a horse, John says. We think it's the name of a group of some kind that may have been involved in Welburn's death. We have a friend who has been threatened by the same people. A few days ago, they tried to kill her. I would be so grateful if you could help us. It could save her life.
Care about her, do you?
John nods. She's a good friend, yeah.
Lynch thinks for a moment or two. Then he makes a decision.
He struggles to his feet, waving away any offer of help, and shuffles over to a low cupboard between the windows. He takes out a tin box and brings it back to the chair.
I shouldn't be doing this. If you tell anyone you got this from me, they'll kill me. But as you've saved my life twice, I suppose I owe you.
With the air circulating in the room, Lynch is talking much more coherently. He fumbles the tin open.
You want to know about a gang that calls itself the Red Circle or something like it? I've never heard of them. But if they're up to no good, there's one place in London that may be able to help you. I know, because I work there as a plongeur. You know, washing the dishes in the kitchen.
He takes two discs out of the tin and hands them to John. They're slightly bigger than the old £5 coins and embossed with the letter B.
These will get you in, but if there's any trouble, don't say I didn't warn you. And whatever you do, don't mention my name. The Bohemia. It's a sort of club under the arches near Waterloo Station. You need to find Leake Street. Don't look for a name or a number on a door, but you'll recognise it.
The Bohemia?
John examines the tokens and is surprised to discover that they are actually small biscuits, long past their sell-by date from the look of them. They have a musty, savoury smell.
It's a burlesque theatre, a restaurant and cocktail bar, a safe place. You can stay the night there. You can hide out there for a year if you have to, but it's much more than that.
Lynch draws a breath.
There's not a crook in London who hasn't found himself at the Bohemia at some time or another. That's where the deals are done, the contacts made, the information exchanged. You remember the Bruce Partington plans? The designs for Britain's last nuclear submarine? That's where they were sold. The Russian mafia, the Tongs and the Triads, the cartels, the Cosa Nostra, they're all regular visitors. You want a getaway driver or safe breaker or sniper even, you'll find them at the Bohemia. They even have a Thursday night recruitment market. Ask for Irene Adler. She runs the place. An extraordinary woman. There's nothing happens in London that she doesn't know about, especially if it's on the wrong side of the law. Exclusively if it's on the wrong side of the law. Something called a red circle or the red triangle or even a red oblong exists, and if she takes a fancy to you, she'll tell you where to find it. Mind you, if she doesn't like you, she'll probably have you thrown under a train. You're just going to have to hope she's in a good mood.
Holmes and Watson take their leave. Lynch assures them that he will be fine. Helping Hand will replace the broken window, and he will find a less lethal way to heat the room. The two of them head back out into Park Lane, John cupping the two tokens in his hand. And already he is asking himself, why on earth would you need a biscuit to get into a club?